Good afternoon and welcome to Power for the People here on Solar Power WERU FM 89.9 in Blue Hill, 99.9 in Bangor, and everywhere in our solar system at WERU.org. I'm your host, Steve Kahl. Power for the People covers energy and personal choices ranging from energy efficiency to advocacy for causes that you believe in. And to me, that is indeed power for the people. And with that lead in, I'd like to introduce my guest today, who will discuss what people can do to educate themselves about climate change and to advocate to reduce climate change. And his name is Peter Dugas, who is the Maine State Coordinator for the Citizens Climate Lobby. And I just learned by email from him that he's also the Regional New England Director for the Citizens Climate Lobby. And we will refer to that probably most of the time here as CCL on this program, just so you're paying attention to the acronyms. As I tend to do here, to talk about recent headlines that have caught my attention at the beginning of this program, despite the fact that I've done research and taught climate science for decades, I was frankly shocked and discouraged to read that New England had two major destructive floods just this month from rainstorms, not from hurricanes, but from rainstorms that meteorologists considered that these things should happen only once in 1,000 years. And these happened in Connecticut and Vermont, right in our backyard. And so editorial, I'll just say, to me, climate change is not a Chinese hoax, despite claims from some elected officials. So welcome, Peter. Glad to have a chance to chat with you.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
So this is the second time that we've covered CCL here on Power for the People. I think the first time was maybe 6 or 7 years ago, so it was a while ago. And so before we get into specifics about what CCL is, again, Citizens Climate Lobby, tell us more about your background, your role with CCL, given that it's just changed anyway, and how you came to be state coordinator and then regional director.
Thank you. Yeah. So, I'm a lifelong Mainer outside of the years I spent outside of the state for college and, you know, trying to get away from the tractor beam that is beautiful Maine coastal life. Grew up outside of Portland, live in Portland now. I guess I had low level climate anxiety growing up. I remember, and for those of us old enough to remember Time Magazine's Person of the Year in 1989, the cover, which I'm staring at actually right now, is reminds me of how the first time I really became cognizant of it was our endangered Earth. When we first started hearing from people like James Hansen and others about the dangers associated with human-based anthropogenic climate change. And, you know, that kind of carried with me at a low level through schooling. And then I was at college. I went to Brown University and graduated with a degree in physics and engineering. And I was doing kind of data entry, low-level kind of research stuff, getting my undergraduate degree in it. Was the first time I really came face to face with the numbers on climate and was freaked out by that. And this was in the go-go 90s, you know, where it looked like we were going to sign the Kyoto Accords and deal with climate the same way we did with kind of the agents that created the ozone hole, just on a bigger scale, you know, tackling the agents that were creating a warming planet. I remember the conversation I had with my doctor, you know, the professor that was scaring me, which was basically, you know, doc, these numbers don't look good. I'm just a kid here, you know, I'm what, 2021, and help me out. How's this, talk me off of the ledge here. And he kind of gave me the talk down of like, well, you know, climate is a dangerous, scary subject, and you got to look at humanity the same way you're looking at these numbers and realize that, you know, there's only so much that we can do if humanity is just a funny species and it intentionally wants to knowingly drive itself off a cliff here, which was not comforting at all. I don't know if he was trying to be comforting. It definitely changed my perspective on like what I should be doing. So that kind of low level was with me for a long time. And I bounced around after graduating and having a job outside of trying to create a career or paths after in the workplace, kind of always had time for climate advocacy. There's all kinds of different organizations that have gone back for a long, long time. I was involved with Maine Interfaith Power and Light, which is a wonderful organization, other groups that are out there. But I really found a home over the past, 7 or 8 years with Citizens Climate Lobby for a number of reasons. I kind of was really appreciative. It pulled me in right away just about how ambitious their scope of work was, how they were trying to be respectful of volunteers' hours by trying to do as much as they could with as little hours as possible. So jumping into the finding what policies would be most effective and equitable, and hitting it at the highest levels possible where it would have the biggest effect. And then when we started getting some success, nothing to the degree that we need, of course, but in recent years, it's been kind of banner years with 2 or 3 federal climate policies passing that each one is a new record on how much we're allocating towards this existential issue. It does make you realize that there's a sea change, a momentum shift, and that there's a lot possible. I also got really pulled in because our little state, Maine, even though we're responsible for very little of U.S. carbon emissions, if you do the math on it, it's something like less than 0.3% of U.S. carbon emissions come from the United States. With that in mind, we actually have more clout on the federal level than any other state for just the weird ways that Congress works, where there's a self-selecting group of 12 senators called the Senate Climate Solutions Caucus. It's a bipartisan group of 12 senators. 6 Republicans, 5 Democrats, one independent, being Angus King. We are the only state with both of our senators on the bipartisan Senate Climate Solutions Caucus, which is actually where a lot of the ideas that were introduced into the bipartisan infrastructure law, which was a climate policy, record-breaking climate legislation. And some of it got into what became the Inflation Reduction Act in 2022. All of these things gave us more optimism that things were really changing and that there's opportunities out there. We just need more work done.
So the Climate Solutions Caucus, which I actually wasn't aware of, must be self-selected. The senators choose to be in it.
That's right. And they like to keep it small. So it's just 12. I think about it this way. We're lucky to have Senator Collins and Senator King both be on that. And they do we call it the Noah's Ark method, where if it's a new Republican who wanted to join, they'd have to find a Democrat or vice versa, because they want to have it even Steven. Hence the Noah's Ark. But even though our little state is responsible for such a teeny weeny little bit of climate changing agents, greenhouse gas emissions, we can do more on the federal and international level because of where our senators sit. New York is roughly 20 times our population, Texas roughly 30 times, California roughly 40 times our population. They all have 0 senators on the select board. So.
And that caucus is mostly just a discussion group, or they help craft legislation?
It's hard to know. I mean, they're not extremely public with what's going on, but I think that it's important to note that they do try, that this exists. There's a House entity as well that's much bigger that is actually looking at what's possible on the bipartisan space on climate change, and just knowing that the intricacies of the Electoral College and gerrymandering, there are certainly places out there that are going to try to wait for the opportunity when there's a single party control over both houses of Congress and the White House. But we'd also need some pressure in the bipartisan space. And the nice thing is, counter to a lot of the bluster we might hear in this election year, there is there's a lot of momentum on both sides. Obviously, one side's obvious, the other side is pretty quiet. But for instance, one of the other things we point to is that, there's a House Conservative Climate Caucus that is led by John Curtis, who is now likely to replace Mitt Romney as the senator from Utah. He was he's a sitting House member. He established that, and it's just Republicans or just conservatives that are on that it's actually has nearly twice as many members as the Freedom Caucus, which we hear so much about on the conservative side. So there is some bubbling on the conservative side on climate, and there's certainly a lot of energy on the progressive side. And, you know, we're trying to just build the opportunities through respectful, long cultivated relationships with every lawmaker we can, from Bernie Sanders to Ted Cruz and everybody in between, to have them move up, we call the climate champion scale, to talk more about climate and particularly to do more about climate. And I'm happy to get into that. But, you know, so we're kind of laser focused on federal level. We have this kind of dance where we meet with our lawmakers two or three times a year. We meet once in person in D.C. and then another one or two times over Zoom meetings, and try to move them along on particular climate policies that are available. And then we go back to constituents and try to get more constituent support and grow the, you know, you could call it friendly pressure to move in the right direction on climate policy that's good for the environment, but also protects the poor and middle income folks as well.
Right. The economy certainly matters. When you say we meet, who's we?
Us volunteers. So we have about 220,000 volunteers nationwide right now. And we just in June, second weekend in June, we were last in DC for our in-person meetings. We met with 442 of the 535 lawmakers available. Every Senate office met with us. And we had over 1,000 volunteers in those meetings.
And the volunteers pay their own way to get to Washington?
Mostly, yeah. We do a little bit of fundraising to try to get some folks who'd like to go who are having a hard time getting there. One of the nice things about CCL is, like, we don't really beg for money very often, because we're such a small organization. It's mostly the engine that runs us is volunteers that are willing to dive into details about climate science, but also about policy that's available. And that's the engine that, you know, the volunteer climate anxiety is really the engine that moves this ship forward.
Right. So you guys consider yourselves nonpartisan. I appreciate that. Volunteer-based. And just for scale, what's the organization's annual budget? Is that something that you can comment on?
You know, that is something I should know, Steve, but I can't tell you. I could get back to you on that, or maybe...
You'd have to kill me first afterwards, right?
Well, actually, no, it's probably public knowledge. I could look it up right now, but I hate to slow it down.
Okay. And you guys are a 501. The CCL part of you is a 501c4, but you did mention to me in email that you actually have a sister, if you will, 501c3?
That's right. So it's Citizens Climate Education is 501c3, which was just about spreading climate awareness and education. Not just climate science, but also public policy, what's available in, you know, at certain points of the, you know, the political ebbs and flows in the country, what's also going on internationally with, you know, international ramifications from carbon tariffs and that sort of thing. That's all 501c3 on education. But we divide that pretty, you know, there's a lot of organizations that do this that have a lobbying arm, and because they lobby, they're 501c4.
Right. So you mentioned that your main policy areas, no big surprise here, include carbon pricing and cashback carbon pricing, electrification, clean energy, and healthy forests. Those are all things that we talk about here on this program. The carbon pricing thing, in the interest of time here, I think is probably something that we've only talked about the one time I had CCL on. Give us. I mean, and I think that's kind of your wheelhouse issue. Is that correct? Talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. The other three, the clean energy permitting reform, healthy forests, and building electrification and efficiency, are all things that we've gotten our hands into a lot more in the past few years, because after getting the Inflation Reduction Act across the finish line and the infrastructure law before that, we realized that there was a lot of opportunities to work on these things that had a lot of ramifications in the states and helped expedite the transition to clean energies in a effective and equitable transition there. But you're right, carbon pricing is kind of the umbrella term, and carbon fee and dividend, which sometimes I prefer to call cash back carbon pricing, is a specific flavor of carbon pricing, has always been kind of our cornerstone, or at least has been for nearly all of the 15 years that CCL has been around. So carbon pricing, basically, as we currently speak, Steve, the U.S. is the only developed nation without some form of a price or downward pressure on carbon pollution or emissions related to carbon burning fossil fuels, that is carbon dioxide. You can have that be a plain old carbon tax, which is by itself, economists may like for its effectiveness, but it's very regressive. It, you know, it hurts the folks who are trying to live paycheck to paycheck, trying to, you know, make ends meet. Because it as Emmanuel Macron, as for example, he found out with the Gilets Jaunes movement a few years ago in France, just upping the price on carbon, tax hurt poor people. The next flavor might be cap and trade, which is better than nothing, which is the Europeans have had for decades now, where different corporations have this kind of market where their ability to emit carbon pollution, greenhouse gas pollution, is traded, that ability. And every year the governments tamp down, bring that level down. So if you're under your quota, you may be able to sell those credits to somebody else. And each year it's supposed to go down and down.
Which is the same as the RGGI model in the Northeast, regional
that's
greenhouse
right.
gas emissions.
Exactly right. RGGI models, the only difference is that it's regional instead of like international, like the EU is doing. And the EU is trying to make their carbon cap and trade emissions economy wide. So they're trying to not just hit electricity, which RGGI is focused on, but also transportation and heating fuel and that and embedded carbon associated. But,
how would the cap and trade work for like gasoline for vehicles? I guess I'm not clear on that.
Yeah. And that's really, we're not advocating for that, so I'm no expert on how the Europeans are trying to tackle that, but I know that they are motivated to increase and spread their carbon pollution price to as many sectors as they can, particularly with what's going on in Eastern Europe with Ukraine's invasion from Russia. And learning the hard way of turning the blind eye towards to the bad, you know, authoritarian actors who are supplying them their cheaper fossil fuels. I think from what my little understanding of what's going on in Europe is that they're doing something similar to what we're advocating with the cashback carbon pricing, which is pricing it at its source, where it comes into the market. So when cashback carbon pricing, which we had 97 co-sponsors on the House bill of what's called the Energy Innovation Carbon Dividend Act in the previous session, including our first district Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, along with many others. That the system is this: you're putting a price on the carbon pollution associated with the fossil fuels where it enters the market. So that means the oil well, the fracking site, the coal mine, or the port of entry where any of those fossil fuels come into the market from international trade. Mm. And it's priced according to how dirty that fuel is when it's burned. So of carbon. So coal would get hurt the hardest, and then oil and then natural gas after that. And what, you know, when you, that as that makes sure if you're pricing it where it enters the market, so no one's paying that price directly, except if you own an oil company, gas company, or coal company. But you're going to, of course, pass those burdens down when you're selling that fuel to the middlemen who eventually come up with all the goods and services that we all consume. So that way it's economy-wide, and it works. So it hits all of the different sectors, including embedded carbon, which for most Americans is where most of their quote unquote carbon footprint comes from, is not, you know, we think about gas prices for our vehicles, heating oil, and for, you know, the components associated with electricity generation. But most of our carbon emissions per capita come from embedded carbon, which means the carbon associated with me getting my cup of coffee in the morning and having all the beans shipped up here, or buying a new shirt and having it delivered to my doorstep, or taking photos of my recent vacation on my phone and putting it online. You know, all that stuff has like an embedded carbon emissions associated with it, with a, you know, gajillion middlemen between where the emissions actually enter the atmosphere and where the product or service is given to the consumer who's looking for it. And the cashback carbon price, the trick is, you know, we like what Canada does, which is to actually give the net revenue from that carbon fee that's paid for only by directly by the fossil fuel companies. And you give the proceeds back as an equal dividend check distributed to every man, woman, and child. The way the law worked in the United States in that bill I was mentioning, the Energy Innovation Carbon Dividend Act, is if you're under 18, you get half a dividend, but everybody else gets monthly payments evenly.
So so we're down to a little under 6 minutes here, and I just want to mention that we are listening to Power for the People here on WERU-FM 89.9 in Blue Hill, 99.9 in Bangor, and my guest today is Peter Dugas, the Maine State Coordinator and Regional New England Director for the Citizens Climate Lobby. So it sounds like countries other than Canada are using a regressive model for carbon pricing.
Yeah, I mean, they're
that leads me to say, let's be very clear, literally in the 5 minutes we have left, for people to understand that what you guys are proposing and what has been discussed in Congress is the cashback, if you will, the dividend model, how that would work. Because that I think that's really important for people to know.
Yes. The big criteria that Citizens Climate Lobby always uses on evaluating policy is it one, effective on climate, and two, does it protect low and middle income folks? And the nice thing is, you know, Canada's system is not perfect. The details, they're doing it quarterly instead of monthly. They sent out the dividends. The most efficient way to do that is to have it buried in your taxes. So it was there for a long time. It had a funny name on your tax, but people were seeing the price of some products going up, but they weren't seeing the dividends. We're always trying to lead with the dividend, where if in New Brunswick, if we were to take a trip up there, a family of four is getting $736 back per year, and that's going to go up with the carbon as the carbon price goes up. So it's a way of, if the modeling, you can go online and check the Citizens Climate Lobby website and see the household impact study or the carbon dividend calculator to see how you would actually fare if this were to pass in the United States. And for most folks, particularly if you're low middle income folks, you actually make bank. You actually are bound to have more money coming in than paying out in increased costs for your goods and services, because most of that money coming in is paid for from the folks with the most discretionary income, or the, you know, the biggest carbon footprints, who are the most affluent. And those folks, you shouldn't be too worried about them, because they have the easiest means to decarbonize their lifestyles. But it really is a means, Steve, of changing the burden from you and me and all the people who might be worried about this issue, from us in our consumer habits, to the supply, the folks who are giving us our goods and services, who are much more sensitive to price fluctuations. And if they know that carbon emissions and doing business and addicted to carbon emissions and the fuels associated with them, if that cost to doing business keeps going up every year, they're going to be highly motivated to decarbonize, which saves them money, which saves the atmosphere damage. And we can just make the right climate decision by how we make all of our other decisions. How much does it cost?
Right. So one of the, and again, we're down to 3 minutes here. One of my concerns that I've talked about with the Central Maine CCL representatives, you know who they are, is that talking about carbon emissions and reducing carbon, most people are going to go, well, it's CO2. Right. When in fact, methane, for example, is 82 times stronger than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. How are you guys differentiating there to be sure that we're addressing the right way to help the climate?
Great question. So, I mean, this is just one policy. You'll be happy to know that even though it did not get much press, methane is actually a price of on methane was included in the Inflation Reduction Act.
And that's the first I'd heard of that. So, you know, give us the 1 minute view of that.
Well, can I? So there, you can find the details of that. I actually can't remember all the details as it comes through, but it would be. But the carbon emissions associated, methane is you're right. It's much, much stronger per unit, but we emit a lot less of it than we do carbon emissions, which we do of just from this country alone. Mount St. Helens, 540 million tons of carbon dioxide emissions just from the United States every 18 minutes. So in the course of this interview, there's a Mount St. Helens up in the atmosphere that we can't see and that doesn't have any ramifications. But methane, you're right, it does dissipate and becomes carbon. It becomes carbon dioxide over a short amount of time. Carbon dioxide stays up there for generations upon generations. We are not just advocating for only carbon. We're just hitting that often because the UN has continued to say that a carbon price is a quote unquote necessary condition for us to stabilize the climate. Gets us about a little more than halfway to where we need to be to get to our Paris Protocol goals. And then the rest of it is dealing with sequestration, which is why we're talking about forests a lot and talking about some of the other agents like methane that we were advocating for with the Inflation Reduction Act price.
Right. And the challenge with methane, of course, is that methane on a molecule by molecule basis, methane is 82 times the power of carbon dioxide. And I know you just alluded to the fact that people say, well, methane goes away in the atmosphere, so it's not that big a deal. To me, the 82 is the key rather than some number like 25, because climate change is a problem right now. I mean, if methane is going to go away in 10 years, that doesn't help us right now. An editorial there.
I would point towards the En-ROADS model, which is easy and free to available, EN-ROADS. And if you put a methane price in similar to what we were talking about, or if you squash methane, you get from expecting a temperature increase from 3.3 to 2.9 degrees centigrade difference. With our carbon price, it goes from 3.3 down to about 2.4 of that increasing carbon price. So, but two of them together, and you get within shout, you get to 2 degrees or less, which is, you know, then you're very close to getting to where we need to be.
All right. Well, you've been listening to Power for the People here on WERU-FM 89.9 in Blue Hill, 99.9 in Bangor, with guest Peter Dugas of the Citizens Climate Lobby. You can learn more about CCL at citizensclimatelobby.org. I think that's the correct website. Power for the People airs the fourth Friday in the public affairs time slot at 4:30. So join us next time to learn more about energy topics, policies, technology, and solutions for your life. Thanks very much.